New Millennium Entertainment presents Stupid White Men and Other Sorry Excuses for the State of the Nation, written by Michael Moore, read by Artie Johnson. Introduction. There are those who say it all started to unravel the night of November 7, 2000, when Jeb Bush gave his brother George Jr. an early Christmas present, the state of Florida. For others, those upon whom a decade's fortune had smiled, the turning point came when the Dow had its biggest annual loss in almost 20 years. For most, though, the day the music died came the night we were told Pluto was no longer a planet, and life as we knew it was as distant as the look in the new president's eyes. Wherever you chose to pinpoint the exact moment when it all crumbled before your eyes, it matters not. The only thing that matters is that we collectively as Americans all know that someone has pulled the plug on our all-night binge. The American century? That's over. Welcome to your Century 21 nightmare. A man no one elected sits in the White House. California can't find enough electricity to operate its juicers or execute its inmates. It's cheaper to FedEx yourself across town than to drive there. Russia and China have signed a new pact just when we dismantled the last of the fallout shelters. Dot-coms have turned into not-coms, making the NASDAQ as safe a bet as a backroom craps game in Reno. The past 2 years have seen the most layoffs since the worst years of the Reagan Renaissance devastated the country. You stand a better chance of dating Catherine Harris or Tom DeLay than of making your Northwest connection in Detroit on a sunny day. What's that you say? You want to talk to a real human being in customer service? Press 4 and kiss the rest of your day goodbye. Oh, and aren't you lucky? You're working two jobs, and so is your wife. And you've got little Jimmy working down at McDonald's, too. So you can afford that new home on the tree-lined street with neatly trimmed lawns and little white picket fences. And look, there goes Spot to greet Grandpa as he pulls onto the driveway. And next month, you're going to make the last payment on that student loan you've had for the past 20 years. But then, suddenly, your company has announced it's moving to Mexico. Without you. Your wife's employer has decided she's no longer needed because the new Humans Resources Consultant believes that one person can easily do the jobs of three. And little Jimmy has come down with an unknown illness from something he ate out of the McNugget fryer. And your HMO says they won't cover little Jimmy's operation, but they'll be happy to treat him as an outpatient if you're willing to drive to Tijuana twice a week because, well, they've built a new outpatient clinic just across the border thanks to free trade, which may or may not be responsible for the worm found in Jimmy's half-eaten McNugget. Oh, sorry, the collection agency just called, and they'd like your new Celica back because you've missed a payment. Hey, maybe when you go to Tijuana and drop Jimmy off, you can head down the street and reapply for your old job, where all the associates are given their own outhouse and fed a free breakfast burrito when they arrive at work at 5 o'clock every morning. Pardon me if I'm dreaming, but weren't things looking up just a year or so ago? Weren't we supposed to be living through the largest economic expansion in history? Hadn't the government ended 55 years of operating in the red and finally boasted a cash surplus large enough to fix every road, bridge, and tooth in America? Air and water pollution were at their lowest levels in decades. Crime was at a record low. Teen pregnancies had dropped out of sight, and more kids were graduating from high school and college than ever before. Old people lived longer. You could call Kathmandu for 12 cents a minute, and the Internet was bringing all the world, save the 2 billion or so who live without electricity, closer together. Palestinians broke bread with Israelis. Catholics shared a pint with Protestants in Northern Ireland. Yes, life was getting a whole lot better, and we all felt it. People were friendlier. Strangers on the street would give you the time of day, and Regis made the questions easier so we could have more millionaires. Then something happened. Investors lost millions in the stock market. Crime went up for the first time in a decade. Job losses skyrocketed. American icons like Montgomery Ward and TWA vanished. Suddenly we were 2.5 million barrels short of oil. Every day, Israelis started killing Palestinians again, and Palestinians returned the favor. By mid-2001, 37 countries were at war around the world. China became our new enemy, again. The United Nations kicked this off their Human Rights Commission, and the European Union attacked us for unilaterally violating the ABM Treaty by reintroducing Star Wars. It was hard, damn hard, to find a good movie. Millions stopped watching network television, and every radio station you tuned in sounded the same. Like crap. In short, all of a sudden, everything sucked. Whether it's the shaky economy, depleted energy supplies, elusive world peace, no job security, no health care, or the simple unusable ballot we were given to pick a president, it has become maddeningly clear to most Americans that nothing seems to work. Firestone tires don't work, and the Ford Explorers that ride atop them don't work either, which means you don't work at all, because you're dead and decapitated and lying in a ditch outside the Dunkin' Donuts. 9/11 doesn't work. 4/11 doesn't work. Cell phones don't work. And when they do, it's some asshole having an argument with his broker at the table next to you while you're trying to eat dinner. Freedom of choice is a thing of the past. We're down to 6 media companies, 6 airlines, 2.5 car makers, and 1 radio conglomerate. Everything you will ever need is at Walmart. You can choose between 2 political parties that sound alike, vote alike, and are funded alike by the same exact wealthy donors. You can choose to wear nondescript pastels and keep your mouth shut, or you can choose to wear a Marilyn Manson t-shirt and get kicked out of school. Britney or Christina, WB or UPN, Florida or Texas, there ain't no friggin' difference, folks. It's all the same, it's all the same, it's all the same. How did all this happen? 3 little words. Stupid white men. Think about it. The Bush boys, who took the slender inheritance of Poppy's political mind, not to mention charisma, and spread it even thinner among themselves. Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Spencer Abraham, and the other old shills Bush revived to prop him up. The CEOs of the Fortune 500, the wizards behind Hollywood and 500 channel TV, hell, the average Joe who sees 15 miles per gallon on his new car sticker and thinks not bad as the ozone clouds part above his head. That's right, the whole planet is being overrun, and I'm convinced it's starting to fight back. One day last February in Chicago, the temperature hit 70 degrees, and what happened? Everyone was like, wow, this is great. People were walking around in shorts, and the beach along Lake Michigan was filled with sunbathers. Boy, I love this weather, said one lady to me on the street. You love this? Let me ask you, if the sun suddenly rose at midnight tonight, would you say, oh, wow, this is beautiful, I love it, more daylight? No, of course you wouldn't. You'd be freaking out on a level that has never been measured. You would be screaming bloody murder that the earth was spinning out of control, heading toward the sun at 1,000,000 miles a second. I doubt anyone would be running to the beach to catch any of those bonus rays. Of course, maybe it's not that bad. Maybe someone just launched 1,000 warheads on Milwaukee. And that's the bright light you're seeing to the north as nuclear fission interacts with vacant boarded-up breweries. Either way, you'd be ripping through so many Hail Marys and God Have Mercies, you might just knock 10 years off your sentence to purgatory. So why on earth do we think a 70-degree day in the coldest month of the year in one of the coldest cities in America is something to crow about? We ought to be demanding action from our representatives and swift retribution against those responsible for these climate changes. This isn't right, folks. Something is terribly wrong. And if you don't believe me, ask that dead, infected cow you're drowning in A1. He knew the answer. But we killed him before we could moo it out of him. But let's not worry about Mother Earth. She's lasted through much worse. Let the tree huggers lose their sleep over it. We're too damn busy trying to make money. Ah, money. The sweet stench of success. A couple years ago, I was talking to a guy in a bar who happened to be a stockbroker. He asked me about my investments. I told him I didn't have any, that I don't own a single share of stock. He was stunned. You mean you don't have a portfolio where you keep your money? No, I don't think it's a good idea to keep your money in portfolios, I replied, or in a briefcase, or even under the futon. I save what little I can in a place called a bank, where I have what the old-timers call a savings account. He was not amused. You're just screwing yourself, he said, and you're being irresponsible. I remember reading you made a lot of money from your first film, right? Do you know how much you'd have today if you'd invested in the stock market 10 years ago? Probably about 30 mil. $30 million? Could have been mine? Oh, what was I thinking? Suddenly I got very queasy, and it felt like all my principles and beliefs were about to end up on my shoes. I excused myself and went outside. Sometime after this event, the stockbroker guy got hold of my home address and started sending me weekly market updates and other propaganda in the hope that I'd give him my kid's college fund to gamble with on the strip known as Wall Street. Well, the investment opportunities flyers have stopped coming. In the past 18 months, Microsoft has gone from $120 to $40, Dell from $50 to $16, and Petscom and its cute little sock puppet have gone to puppy heaven. The Nasdaq has lost nearly 40% of its value, and average Americans, snookered into the madness of playing the market with their meager savings, have lost billions. Any thoughts of early retirement we may have entertained are out the window. We'll be lucky if they let us cut back to 40 hours a week when we're 82, or incontinent, whichever comes first. Actually, not all of us. There are almost 56,000 new millionaires in the country, and they've made out like bandits. They made their money because they already had a goodly sum to begin with, and then invested it in companies that got rich by throwing people out of work, exploiting children and the poor in other countries, and receiving big reductions in their taxes. For them, greed wasn't good, it was mandatory. In fact, they were so good at creating a climate of greed that the word itself went out of style. Now it's called success, and yes, it comes with its own punctuation. Soon, virtually no one questioned all this gluttony as wrong or obscene. It became such a part of our daily life that when this character from Texas got greedy and took an election he didn't win, we stood back and gave it to him. He wasn't being greedy after all, just being smart. Just as corporate agriculture's dicey schemes to corrupt the genetic makeup of your cornflakes aren't insane or greedy. That's progress. Just as the guy next door who wants the biggest SUV ever built isn't being greedy. He just wants more torque, baby. This stupid white virus is so powerful, it has even infected ringers like Colin Powell, Interior Secretary Gail Norton, and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, and it's created a deep funk, a grand national funk you can feel wherever you go. It has permeated us so profoundly, I wonder if we'll ever recover. Of course, we're all trying hard to forget about the moment when this ugly cultural shift hit critical mass and the forces of evil took over. I know what it is, you know what it is, even an idiot like Britt Hume knows what it is. It's that damn stolen election. Stolen, hijacked, abducted, and ripped from the very hands and hearts of the American people. There is absolutely no dispute over who got the most votes, and there's little question now about the shenanigans that took place in Florida. Yet he who won is not the man we see playing wiffle ball on the South Lawn this afternoon. Yes, we're all telling ourselves nothing all that bad really happened. Get over it, we've been told. But the events of those 36 days shook us hard, knocked the wind out of us, and wedged something deep in our national craw. Nothing short of one big national Heimlich maneuver can save us now. We're stumbling around blue in the face, wondering if relief will ever come in time. Will I have my job next year? What will happen in my retirement fund? Do ice cubes count as a food group? You do not count. It's a tough lesson to learn. And tougher still to discover that all the stuff you've always been told to do, vote, obey the law, recycle your wine cooler bottles, doesn't really matter either. You might as well pull the shades and take the phone off the hook, because you and your fellow Americans have just been declared irrelevant. Your services as a citizen, we regret to inform you, are no longer required. So confusion reigns, and the seismic tremors of national frustration are starting to rumble beneath our feet. The grumbling isn't subsiding, it's growing each day. 8 months after the election, deep into 2001, a Fox News poll announced that nearly 60% of the American public had not gotten over how Bush took the White House, that we're still angry. That's a long time to harbor aggressive ill will toward our leader. A mood that swings out of control like this, with no prompting from refined sugar or Oprah, is a mood that can alter history. Millions of Americans from all points on the political spectrum are feeling off balance, unsure, upset, unglued. The rest are in prison. The common view in the heartland is that the ship of state is running on fumes, and no one's at the wheel. After all, the designated driver wasn't designated by anyone, and he's a self-confessed drunk driver to boot. Hardcore Republicans are desperately hoping that Big Dick Cheney can survive half a dozen more heart attacks and last long enough to oversee the raping and pillaging of everything west of Wichita. What they don't realize is that he's already put the rest of the country into cardiac arrest. Meanwhile, he and his gang are double-timing it to dismantle as much of the environment, the Constitution, and the evidence in Tallahassee as they can before the EMS called Electron 2002 arrives. And there's one thing I'm certain of. There's a triage a-coming. The American public will be turning off the life support system on this administration faster than you can say Jack Splat Kevorkian. So hack away, Miss Norton. Last I heard, trees grow back. Bombs away, Mr. Rumsfeld and General Powell. We're all out of Sergeant McVeigh's for you to pin medals on. Drill away, Mr. Abraham. We'll have you parking those big ass hogs at the Grosse Pointe Yacht Club before you know it. Soon, like good St. Jeffords of Vermont, the elephants will be jumping from the sinking ship. The rest of us will just sit back and enjoy the show while contemplating how to make next month's house payment and where to take cover as the remains of Antonin Scalia rain down upon us like a cold shower in January. Hey, damn it, wait! It's not supposed to rain in January. So, the panic builds. The media can turn and look the other way if they want, and the pundits can keep trying to sell their lies by repeating them so often that they start seeming true. But we millions of Americans aren't going to fall for that deception. The stock market isn't just going through a natural cycle. There's nothing beneficial about genetically enhanced beef. The bank doesn't want to work with you to help you catch up. And the cable guy isn't coming between 8 a.m. and 5 p.m., or any other time for that matter. It's all a bunch of hooey from top to bottom. And as soon as they recognize we're onto them, the sooner we'll get our country back. Today, I took my year-old car, with less than 4,000 miles on it, into the repair shop at the dealership where I bought it. Why? Seems that every other time I go to start the car, it won't start. I've replaced the starter, the battery, the fuse, the computer chip, but none of that has solved the problem. When I told the service manager all this, he looked at me with a withering, vacant stare. Oh, those new Beetles. They don't start unless you drive them every day. I thought for sure I must have heard him wrong. After all, he was speaking perfect English, so I asked him again what the problem was. You see, he said, shaking his head in pity, these VWs are run by a computer system, and if the computer hasn't read any activity, namely you turning it on and driving it every day or so, then the computer assumes the battery is dead or something and just shuts down the whole car. Is there any way you or someone you know can go down to the garage and start it once a day? I didn't know what to say. If you don't start the car every day, it will die? What is this, 1901? Am I being arrogant to expect that a car I spent $20,000 on is supposed to start whenever I put the key in the ignition? There aren't many sure things left in the world these days. The sun still sets in the west. The Pope still says midnight mass on Christmas Eve. Strom Thurmond still comes back to life whenever there's an ex-first lady around to grope. I would have thought I could cling to at least this one last article of faith. A brand new car always starts. Period. Like 95% of the customers you've sold these new Beetles to, I said, I live in Manhattan. Do you know anybody in Manhattan who drives their car every day? Yes, sir, we understand. Nobody in the city drives a car every day. They use the subways. I don't know why they even sell these cars in the city. It's really a shame. Have you tried writing to Volkswagen? Is there a kid on your block you can get to start it for a few minutes every day or so? So, I'm stuck with a car that doesn't run in a country where nothing works, everything sucks, and it's every man, woman, and state-tested child for themselves. Survival of the richest. No more lifeboats for you, or you, or you. There's got to be a better way. Chapter 1, A Very American Coup. The following message was intercepted by UN forces on 9101 at 0600 hours from somewhere within the North American continent. I am a citizen of the United States of America. Our government has been overthrown. Our elected president has been exiled. Old white men wielding martinis and wearing dickies have occupied our nation's capital. We are under siege. We are the United States government in exile. Our numbers are not insignificant. There are over 154 million adults among us and 80 million children. That's 234 million people who did not vote for and are not represented by the regime that has placed itself in power. Al Gore is the elected president of the United States. He received 539,898 more votes than George W. Bush, but he does not sit tonight in the Oval Office. Instead, our elected president roams the country without purpose or mission, surfacing only to lecture college students and replenish his stash of Little Debbie's snack cakes. Al Gore won. Al Gore, president in exile. Long live El Presidente Alberto Gore! So who then is the man who now occupies 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue? I'll tell you who. He is George W. Bush, President of the United States, the thief in chief. It used to be that politicians would wait until they were in office before they became crooks. This one came prepackaged. Now he is a trespasser on federal land, a squatter in the Oval Office. If I told you this was Guatemala, you'd believe it in a heartbeat, no matter what your political stripe. But because this coup was wrapped in an American flag, delivered in your choice of red, white, or blue, those responsible believe they're going to get away with it. That's why, on behalf of 234 million Americans held hostage, I have requested that NATO do what it did in Bosnia and Kosovo, what America did in Haiti, what Lee Marvin did in the Dirty Dozen. Send in the Marines, launch the Scud missiles, bring us the head of Antonin Scalia. I have sent a personal request to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan to hear our plea. We are no longer able to govern ourselves or to hold free and fair elections. We need UN observers, UN troops, UN resolutions. Damn it! We need Jimmy Carter. We are now finally no better than a backwater banana republic. We are asking ourselves why any of us should bother to get up in the morning to work our asses off to produce goods and services that only serve to make the junta and its cohorts in corporate America a separate, autonomous fiefdom within the United States that has been allowed to run on its own for some time, even richer. Why should we pay our taxes to finance their coup? Can we ever again send our sons off into battle to give their lives defending our way of life, when all that really means is the lifestyle of the gray old men holed up in the headquarters they seized by the Potomac? Oh, Jesus, Mary and Joseph, I can't take it. Somebody pass me the universal remote. I need to switch back to the fairy tale that I was a citizen in a democracy with an inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happy meals. The story I was told as a child said that I mattered, that I was equal to every one of my fellow citizens, and that not a single one of us was to be treated differently or unfairly, that no one was to wield power over others without their consent. The will of the people. America, the beautiful land that I love. Twilight's last gleaming. Oh, say, can you see? Are the Belgian peacekeepers on their way? Hurry! The coup began long before the shenanigans on Election Day 2000. In the summer of 1999, Catherine Harris, an honorary stupid white man who was both George W. Bush's presidential campaign co-chairwoman and the Florida Secretary of State in charge of elections, paid $4 million to Database Technologies to go through Florida's voter rolls and remove anyone suspected of being a former felon. She did so with the blessing of the governor of Florida, George W.'s brother, Jeb Bush, whose own wife was caught by immigration officials trying to sneak $19,000 worth of jewelry into the country without declaring and paying tax on it. A felony in its own right. But hey, this is America. We don't prosecute felons if they're rich or married to a governing Bush. The law states that ex-felons cannot vote in Florida, and sadly, though I'm confident that Florida's justice system was always unimpeachably fair, that means 31% of all black men in Florida are prohibited from voting because they have a felony on their record. Harrison Bush knew that removing the names of ex-felons from the voter rolls would keep thousands of black citizens out of the voting booth. Black Floridians, overwhelmingly, are Democrats. And sure enough, Al Gore received the votes of more than 90% of them on November 7th, 2000. That is, 90% of those who were allowed to vote. In what appears to be a mass fraud committed by the state of Florida, Bush, Harris, and Company not only removed thousands of black felons from the rolls, but they also removed thousands of black citizens who had never committed a crime in their lives, along with thousands of eligible voters who had committed only misdemeanors. How did this happen? Harris's office told Database, a firm with strong Republican ties, to cast as wide a net as possible to get rid of these voters. Her minions instructed the company to include even people with similar names to those of the actual felons. They insisted Database check people with the same birth dates as known felons or similar Social Security numbers. An 80% match of relevant information, the election office instructed, was sufficient for Database to add a voter to the ineligible list. These orders were shocking, even to Bush-friendly Database. They would mean that thousands of legitimate voters might be barred from voting on election day just because they had a name that sounded like someone else's or shared a birthday with some unknown bank robber. Marlene Thorogood, the Database project manager, sent an email to Emmett Bucky Mitchell, a lawyer for Catherine Harris's election division, warning him that, unfortunately, programming in this fashion may supply you with false positives or misidentifications. Never mind that, said old Bucky. His response, obviously we want to capture more names that possibly aren't matches and let county election supervisors make a final determination rather than exclude certain matches altogether. Database did as they were told. And before long, 173,000 registered voters in Florida were permanently wiped off the voter rolls. In Miami-Dade, Florida's largest county, 66% of the voters who were removed were black. In Tampa's county, 54% of those who would be denied the right to vote on November 7, 2000 were black. But culling names from Florida's records alone was not enough for Harris and her department. 8,000 additional Floridians were thrown off the voting rolls because Database used a false list supplied by another state, a state which claimed that all the names on the list were former convicted felons who had since moved to Florida. It turns out that the felons on the list had served their time and had all their voting privileges reinstated, and there were others on the list who had committed only misdemeanors, such as parking violations or littering. What state was it that offered Jeb and George a helping hand by sending this bogus list to Florida? Texas. This entire incident stunk to the high heavens, but the American media ignored it. It took the British Broadcasting Corporation to dig deep into this story, running 15-minute segments on its primetime news program, revealing all the sordid details and laying responsibility for the scam right at the doorstep of Governor Jeb Bush. It's a sad day when we have to look to a country 5,000 miles away to find out the truth about our own elections. Eventually, the Los Angeles Times and the Washington Post picked up the story, but it received little attention. This assault on the voting rights of minorities was so widespread in Florida that it even affected people like Linda Howell. Linda received a letter informing her that she was a felon.